Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the day after the election, and it is President Barack Obama. And I'm sure that many of you will want to call in during the course of the next 2 hours to analyze what happened and to talk about this very, very long campaign and what happened around the country and really around the world last night. John McCain's very gracious concession speech, why it is that Obama was able to win this election the way that he did. And we have many guests with us to talk about all that happened yesterday. History has been made, as everybody knows, and we'll talk about how it happened and the grave, grave times in which we live and how difficult the next 4 years, 8 years and beyond will be for Barack Obama should he be reelected. And he made mention in Grant Park last night of how these are serious times, and all that he wants to accomplish may not happen in the first year or the first term, but he will be there. So it was an extraordinary night in many ways, and we have so much to talk about. David Michael Green is joining us the first half hour, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Later this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer, who's Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. And the second hour of our program today, the author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State. So all of that is coming up. Now, please join us with your phone calls if you're awake yet. I know many of us were up late, but you think of these people who are on the campaign trail who probably haven't slept very much for 2 years. So it's okay to get a night with not too much sleep, don't you think? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we start with Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Professor, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
So it was an election. You know, I was thinking a lot about Studs Terkel, who died on Halloween and who was on this show many times. And one of his books was Hope Dies Last. I thought about that title as I looked at the faces that you saw around the country and some in various parts of the world last night, that there was a hope about this that maybe we are terribly hungry for. And we don't know exactly how we will govern, but we were voting for hope in one way. Do you think we were?
Oh, absolutely. I think this was easily the most emotional election of my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I'm 50 years old, and there have been some pretty powerful emotional currents that have run through many of our electoral battles in the past that I've lived through, and of course before that. But this was an election where I saw, you know, anecdotally, kind of everywhere I turned, people really expressing high degrees of emotion and engagement in the election, and absolutely do think it represented a turning away from kind of the darker angels, the darker side of our character and our politics, and a grasping of a kind of new hope and a desire to reform the country and turn in a new direction politically, but also in this sort of emotional way that I was alluding to.
Right. And you could see it on the faces of people everywhere, many places in the world, when you watched television last night, couldn't you? The faces were, you just wanted snapshots because they said it all.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, the world always tunes into, you know, what America does, and particularly when we choose presidents. But, of course, this is a whole different kettle of fish. And, you know, you have this very international individual whose character and experience and even genetic DNA, you know, draws from different parts of the world. And he sort of represents this amalgam of different strains throughout the world, and I think represents a kind of hopefulness for people outside of America as well as inside, in the sense that you know, America can stand for a kind of new internationalism, perhaps. I think definitely a turning away from some of the isolationist directions, some of the kind of arrogance that's characterized our foreign policy in the last 8 years. And so both at home and internationally, I mean, the expressions that you saw on people's faces, I mean, Jesse Jackson's was just remarkable.
Yes.
to see that, but you see that in a lot of places in America and elsewhere.
Yeah, you sure do. He ran, and we saw evidence of this when we were in Iowa, certainly in January, that he ran this this flawless campaign, not flawless, but almost flawless. When you look at the organization on the ground, when you we were noting last night at my house, we had people over, that the sign on the door, you know, thing you put over the doorknob, we didn't get any for McCain, but we had one for Obama, and it even had the listing of the voting place to go to. I thought, I don't think I've ever seen this before. This is where you vote. It was down to that kind of detail.
Yeah, I mean, they were incredibly smart, and I think this is really, this has gone a little bit under the radar, and this is something to really, I think, pay attention to. My expectation right now, and it's so obviously so ridiculously early to have an expectation about this, but I really do believe that this is going to be a very successful presidency for exactly that reason. I think Obama is a really smart guy, and we've had really smart guys in the White House who haven't necessarily had super successful presidencies. I mean, one thinks of Jimmy Carter, for example, or Bill Clinton. But I think that Obama is not only intellectually smart, but he's just really politically adroit, and he's got this community organizer, you know, history to him and proclivity, which Sarah Palin kind of mocked, but arguably, for reasons that you just alluded to, it had a lot to do with him being where he is today. I mean, if he hadn't won Iowa, I don't think he would have won the Democratic nomination and obviously wouldn't be president. And I think he won Iowa by sort of slipping under the radar and out-hustling and out-thinking and out-organizing, you know, the Hillary Clinton juggernaut.
Mm-hmm. When you think about it, we've said this so many times, but it's worth repeating today, what this man was able to do is just unbelievable. The fact that he was able to defeat Hillary Clinton. That's extraordinary.
Oh, right. And really unexpected. And I think there were several reasons for that. One is the one that I just described. I mean, they just ran a really smart campaign. And they did it a little bit initially under the radar. And they figured out that they could, you know, sort of nickel and dime convention delegates by winning in these caucus states where, you know, she just figured they were not relevant. She'd go in and she'd win the big primaries. So they ran a really smart campaign, I think. The Clinton campaign, by all accounts, was rather the opposite of that. And it was maybe bloated and sort of bloated also with a sense of inevitability. And then the third thing I think that we have to remember is that amongst the three leading Democratic candidates, Clinton, Edwards, and Obama, he was the only anti-war candidate back when it counted. And, of course, Democratic voters are more anti-war than the country as a whole. And those are the voters that choose the Democratic nominee. And so I think this, you know, that really paid off for Obama, the fact that back in 2002, of course, he wasn't in the United States Senate then, but back in 2002, he had rejected the Iraq War, and the other two had not. And so, I mean, I think the race would have turned out differently, and he would not be where he is today, president-elect of the United States, had that not been the case.
And what about his victory being tied directly to where we are economically? Would he have won had we not had this serious economic news toward the end of the campaign?
Well, I think it would have been a toss-up had that not been the case. I mean, that's what the poll data seem to show. And the poll data, I think, have been reasonably reliable this year, with the exception of the Democratic primary in New Hampshire. And even there, the data might have been reliable. There was a last-minute incident with Hillary expressing some emotions, and so actually that may not have been captured by the poll data. In that sense, it may have been accurate. But what the poll data has been showing, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, McCain actually had a slight lead, if not, you know, if the race wasn't a toss-up at that point. And then the financial crisis hit like a tidal wave, and it really affected the McCain stature in the race, and I think his handling of it affected his prospects in the race, whereas Obama was seen as kind of a calm and mature manager of the crisis, to the extent that, you know, he was outside the government at that point, outside the presidency at least. But I do think that mattered, and I do think that, you know, in any general election in our era, when it comes to economic questions, Democrats tend to get the nod from voters, just like Republicans tend to get the nod on national security issues. So that's a really remarkable thing, actually, because in so many ways, this should have been a virtually impossible year for a Republican nominee, and yet had that financial crisis not happened, it might have been McCain's victory last night. And the other thing that's really remarkable about it is, let's just say that this is, let's hope it's not, but let's just say that this is the economic storm of a century, which means that kind of, if you take that very literally, it could hit in any one of, 1,200 months. And from Obama's perspective, it hit in sort of the perfect month. Imagine if this had hit in, November or in January. It would have obviously been irrelevant to the race, and it would have probably changed the character of the race and maybe changed the outcome.
Right. I don't think you can underestimate. It'll be interesting to see more analysis of this as the weeks go on. But it seems to me as though John McCain made the wrong choice for the vice presidential candidate, that she figured in. She was compelling to watch. She really energized, of course, people have said, the base. But she wasn't qualified, and even people at the top of the party were saying she wasn't qualified to be president, considering his age, considering the number of gaffes she made. She just wasn't up to the task. And I think that made a difference in this election.
Oh, absolutely. And the poll data confirms that. I mean, she was a drag on the ticket. And I think she was perceived widely by the public, as well, as you mentioned, by even leaders of her own party, as not qualified to do the job, which I think is a fair characterization. I mean, I actually think Sarah Palin's a pretty smart person, and I think she has, probably pretty great, actually, political instincts. I don't mean that in terms of her policy preferences, but which I don't agree with, but I mean in terms of her, as a political animal, capable of winning elections and so forth. But what I think was clearly the case and emerged, particularly in the Katie Couric interview, was that when it comes to the great issues of our time, national issues and international issues, she was just she had just been tuned out. She just was absolutely clueless about this, and they were trying to kind of, trying to fake that, and it was just really apparent that she didn't know this stuff. She didn't even know what newspapers she claimed to be reading, which was, fairly transparently ridiculous. And it reflected on her, but I think it reflected very poorly on John McCain. I mean, John McCain had been saying that we have this great international crisis, the fight against Islamofascism, which is the transcendental issue of our time, and that, Iraq is the central front in this war. And then he picked somebody who had said, several months earlier that she didn't really know much about Iraq. And it just suggested, and I think rightly so, that he made a pick. He made it hastily, which was really pretty amazing, and rather impulsively. But more importantly, he made a pick that benefited him politically, or so he thought, to the peril of the nation, which was really, I think that really undermined his stock in trade, his claim to be a sort of patriot who rises above politics and who puts country first, as his slogan said.
Professor David Michael Green is our guest the first half hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, or you can send an email at talk@wpr.org. And it's the day after the election, so let's talk about what happened. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor David Michael Green is our guest the first half hour, and we go to Rich from Sullivan for our first call. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. I'm pretty happy. I'm happy that the younger guy got it. I'm not an ageist because I'm soon to be 65, and I just think it's good that we're sort of passing the torch. On the BBC last night, I'm sure I heard interviews with Iranian youths. If anybody else listens to the BBC, in the late hours of the evening or the early morning hours, as I do when I'm reading, I'd like to know. But in the interviews, one young man was saying they're downplaying this here. They don't want us to know. They're making it seem like it's insignificant. And he was obviously very animated and thought that it was very, very significant. I found that to be a hopeful sign that people who might not have our interests at heart, I mean the leaders of Iran, or might be oppositional to us in some unreasoned negative ways, are going to be impacted by what America really is. I had my doubts. I was thinking, gee, is there going to be a Bradley effect? And I'm ashamed to say that I had those doubts. I am just amazed that when I was growing up and I watched football, college football was all white. It isn't any longer. And I also participated in the civil rights movement to the degree that I could as a white guy. But I think this is internationally really significant, or potentially so.
Well, that's an interesting point. What about the international significance of this, Professor Green?
No, I think it's huge. You know, I mean, I think America has frankly been off course, off its traditional role, off its traditional post-World War II role in the last 8 years. You know, presidents before George W. Bush, including his father, Republicans and Democrats, had differed on international issues, but within a certain kind of bounded centrist tendency, which included engagement of the world, which included multilateralism wherever possible, and occasional unilateralism, and which included some kind of measure of humility. And the Bush administration has really been a departure in all those ways, and the repercussions of that have been tremendous. And so just to go back to the initial point that the caller was making, I mean, this was a bad day for America's enemies. I would have to characterize it that way, because I think Obama's going to reverse all those tendencies. I think the very fact of Obama begins to reverse all those tendencies and many more beyond those. I mean, I think, as we were talking about earlier, this is just a kind of beacon to the world that this very kind of international, cosmopolitan, a black man can be president of the United States. I mean, that's just going to change our reputation, that alone, in tremendous ways. But then I think his policy choices are going to return us to this era of cooperation with the world and restore our relations with our allies and restore, you know, this America's moral place in the world. And, you know, to the extent that our enemies have been feeding off the fact that our reputation has been very low in the last decade, that's not good news for them.
Thank you, Rich, so much, as always, for your thoughtful comments. Let's go to Jessica from Shorewood. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, good morning. When I was watching this whole thing happen, well, last night and throughout the whole event, I kept thinking back to my history classes and the first televised debate with Kennedy and Nixon, and how Kennedy really knew how to use the media of television when it was brand new. And I think that the Obama campaign really knew how to use the internet. And I really think that kind of correlates to the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And I was wondering about your thoughts on that.
Oh, I think that's clearly the case. I mean, I'm not sure this was the first internet-savvy campaign. Maybe Howard Dean owns that honor from 2004, but it was certainly the most internet-savvy campaign, the most technologically savvy campaign. And it had to be in order to do what it wanted to do and successfully did, which was, you know, to mobilize the youth vote in enormous ways. And, you know, I mean, this showed up in so many ways, from fundraising to organizing, but maybe the classic example of this was when so many people, particularly young people, learned who Obama's vice presidential choice was when they got text messages on their cell phones.
It's right. It's a whole different world, isn't it? And we were talking about, this isn't something that just Obama has done. The New York Times had an interesting letter to the editor, and I think they're right about this. When we were talking about hope earlier, quoting Ronald Reagan here, whatever else history may say about me when I'm gone, I hope it will record that I appeal to your best hopes, not your worst fears. That's what Reagan brought us as well.
Well, that's what he hoped for.
Right, I mean, right. But he ran on that.
He did. And I think the reality for Reagan was mixed. I mean, I think he did restore a certain sense of pride for Americans. For my own politics and my own sense of history, I think there was, in many cases, awfully high degrees of deception there, and policies that I think still to this day were awfully destructive to the country. Not all of them, but certainly some of them. So I think the record for Reagan is rather mixed in that respect, but I do think this is a turning point. I think we've had a politics of fear and hopelessness in this country, particularly in the last decade. And I think one of the great aspects of this election, it's subtle, but it's hugely important, is a rejection of that sort of politics, and particularly as it's exemplified by the kind of, you know, swift boating, dirty trick style, Karl Rove, Lee Atwater character of political infighting, which John McCain himself was a victim of, and many other people have been, John Kerry as well, Michael Dukakis. I think that what we've seen in this election, perhaps even the last two elections, is a rejection of that, and a rejection of the cynicism and fear and hopelessness as a organizing principle of our politics, to a degree that gives me hope that actually we're maybe going to transcend that to some degree and move forward into something that represents a brighter day for not only our politics and our policies, but the way that we do politics.
Mm-hmm. Jessica, thanks for the call. Let's go to Alicia from Beloit. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the
sure.
air. I'm calling kind of to respond to your guest and his characterization of Sarah Palin being one of John McCain's missteps. And I just, you know, I sat last night watching the polls come in. And first of all, I want to say that I was undecided up until the last minute as a voter, and I've traditionally voted Democrat. And one of the reasons I was having such a hard time is because it was a choice I felt between two really great men with love for the country and hope and vision. So, you know, maybe I'm, I don't know how many people agree with me, but that was where I was at. But I sat watching the polls last night, and the first thing, as it, you know, was becoming very obvious that the polling before the election was correct and that Obama was going to become our president, I said, you know, I was talking to my best friend, and I said, they're going to blame McCain's loss on Sarah Palin. And I say this with a lot of pride and hope for the future. I think this election showed that we've made great leaps and bounds with racism in this country, but I think we have a long way to go with sexism. And when your guest was talking about the Couric interviews, you know, the lines throughout the campaign have been she couldn't recite what newspaper she read and the gaffes that she made in her interviews. And I just, you know, to me, when I was watching those interviews, I just thought they were poor interviews because she was being overwhelmed and prepped for her role because she had just come on the scene. And it just strikes the nerve with me that's what people are going to be saying today, and I've already heard on so many different shows that, you know, McCain's misstep was putting Palin on his ticket, because I thought it was a brilliant move.
Mm-hmm. Professor Green.
Well, no, I mean, I think in some ways we're making the same point. I mean, I think that you agree with me that she was unprepared for the role that she was cast in, and that's the only point that I'm making. As I tried to make clear, I don't think that she's unintelligent. I think that she's probably very politically skilled. But I simply think it was a matter of her being very focused on, let's say, Alaska politics, perhaps focused on energy issues, perhaps very focused on her family. And I my sense of her is that she just hadn't tuned in over the last, you know, 30 years to the great issues of American national politics and international politics. I mean, she frankly had said to an interviewer several months ago, I don't really know much about Iraq. Well, you know, how could you go through the last 5-6 years and not know about Iraq as a serious candidate for the highest office in the land? And so I don't think at all that and I hope that this isn't, and I don't think that this is where Americans are going with this, that, you know, this suggests that women are not capable of being president. I don't think that's the interpretation of the country, and it's certainly not my interpretation. But what it suggests, and frankly, I know many, many women who were insulted by the choice of Sarah Palin for exactly that reason, because they feel like she was chosen because of her gender, and then they were insulted by the fact that she seemed really not prepared for the position. And they want to be respected for what they can do and what they do, in fact, know. And there were other women within the party that McCain might have chosen who, in fact, would not have had that problem at all. So, I think it reflects sort of badly on Palin, but it really reflects, and not even badly so much as that she was just doing something different, I think, but it really reflects poorly on John McCain, it strikes me. I mean, when you're a candidate for president, you only have one or two main opportunities during the campaign to make sort of presidential-level decisions, and choosing your running mate is one of them. And I think he made a grave error in that respect.
Professor David Michael Green, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. We're just changing guests. Your phone calls are still welcome. Stay right on the line because we're getting your phone calls both hours. We just are looking at the results of the election yesterday. And our guest, who's been with us several times and is a keen analyst of all things political, Julian Zelizer, will be joining us momentarily. The second hour of our program, the author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do. And we, of course, will be centering on the Obama campaign and how they were able to achieve a fairly large electoral victory yesterday and how they were able to turn some red states blue. So that should be an interesting conversation, the whole ground operation of this campaign and what the ramifications are for, is there a new coalition here? What about the Northeast? What about the South? What about the West? What's changed as a result of this election? Phone number for you to call is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Julian Zelizer is with us now. Hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. So how'd you spend last night?
Just watching like everyone else. I was just by myself.
Were you really?
Well, yeah, just at home.
Right.
No parties or anything.
Yeah, I had a party last night, but it means you stay up too late and ate too much pizza and
exactly.
Cake and all of that. But so what went through your mind when you were watching all of it? I just thought it was a remarkable night on so many levels, on the ground operation on the part of Obama, on the faces that you saw on television, the hope that people have, the enormity of the job that he faces. It was just all there. It was all there in a night. It just didn't even seem real in some ways.
No, obviously there was one level. This was just so historic. To see an African-American win, to see the kind of enthusiasm from, you know, average Americans for a candidate. I can't recall the last time people were going out on the streets to celebrate a new president.
Yes.
And so there was something very special, both for the history of race and civil rights, to just people enthused about a politician is very refreshing to see. And then there was the political story, you know, to see a Democrat doing well in a state like Virginia and North Carolina, countering some of the arguments in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania that Republicans made, some of the Senate losses that we saw, like Elizabeth Dole, kind of was just interesting to watch as Democrats seem to be making some traction in places they haven't been able to do that for years, decades even.
So what does that mean for their likelihood of the way they'll be governing, their ability to govern, their ability to change direction on some fairly substantial issues like health care, like the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, like the economy?
There's opportunity and there's cost. I mean, the 50-state strategy that Howard Dean has been pushing for a long time and that Obama and Axelrod embraced, the benefit is, you know, they can't claim that this is a coastal Democrat. This is a Democrat who only represents a portion of America who are sitting at Starbucks and, you know, drinking lattes. This is not, it's not that Democrat. He won in conservative states. And there's going to be some new Democrats in the Senate who also won in Republican states. And so I think at that level, not just the numbers he's going to have, which are better than before, but also the kind of mandate he has will be a positive to pushing a bill and saying, look, this is not something pushed from the Ivy League of America. It's pushed from Main Street America. On the other hand, there will naturally be more divisions within among Democrats in Congress and among the voters he's going to need for 2012, which will push him in some ways toward caution. And so I think the first year we'll be trying to balance these two pressures.
You talk about McCain's campaign in a recent piece in Newsweek and how it's an aimless and chaotic operation made worse by poor choices at key moments. What are some of those moments? And I mean, I agree with you. How come this campaign wasn't much more highly disciplined?
Yeah, I thought, my point was that these are bad circumstances for any Republican, and they faced a very formidable Democrat, but the campaign just was not very good, and there's a history of campaigns. I don't know what the explanation is. Part of it is the people who ran it. So they picked a vice presidential running mate who I don't think was very effective for John McCain, and
right.
I think in many ways backfired. It lacked any broader message. There was no clear strategy in terms of the map. They were moving from one state to the other, and it was poorly performed. The week of the financial crisis, I think John McCain really harmed his candidacy. It wasn't just the financial crisis, it was what he did. And so part of it was about the people behind it. Obviously, people like Steve Schmidt, who took over the campaign in the summer, didn't do a very good job, and John McCain made some poor choices. But there's also a bigger issue. I think conservatives in a period right now where they're in something of a crisis. They're a lot like liberals were in the 1970s, lacking leaders, lacking ideas, and I think that comes out in campaigns. That's part of what you see is not just the candidate, it's what's going on with the movement behind him.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of gains in the Senate? We're not completely clear. I guess there'll be some recounts here, but gains in the Senate and gains in the House.
In the Senate, it was good, not great for Democrats. I mean, still, you know, to have this size of a majority is something that seemed unimaginable in 2004. So we have to remember, even though they don't have a filibuster-proof Senate, they have a pretty large majority, and in the House as well. There were a few races they were hoping to win, like knocking off Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, which didn't happen. It looks like Norm Coleman won in Minnesota from what I saw last, and Al Franken's loss is also, I think, a disappointment because it looked at the end like he was going to win. But I think, you know, the numbers are close enough to a filibuster-proof Senate, and Republicans are in enough of a state of disarray that there's going to be some willing to bolt and join forces with Democrats, that they're in pretty good position. But it is a kind of little reminder that, you know, Democrats, this is not a sweep for Democrats. They did extremely well, but in certain areas, Republicans were able to hold their ground, even with the conditions they face.
Right. Let's go to phone calls for you, Terrell from Eau Claire. Hi, Terrell.
How you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good, we better, but I was calling about to make a comment. I'm a truck driver, and yes, I'm a supporter of Obama. And matter of fact, when the whole election was going on, the process last night, I was in Gary, Indiana, on my way from Minnesota. I just stopped in Indiana just so I could see how it's going for Illinois and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And what really surprised me was the fact that after the election, I listen to my CB sometimes, and most times I usually leave it off. But when I cut my CB on, next thing you know, I'm hearing all kind of truck drivers, like more white truck drivers than anything, just cussing, talking about, just calling black people out their name and everything, like this is an atrocity type thing. And I'm like, well, half of y'all didn't even vote.
They were saying this.
Why is there still so much animosity toward the fact of there being a black president, but people really don't actually see it unless you got to be, you know what I'm saying, in the situation, like what I do for a living.
Right. So you were hearing this as you were driving after the results, after he won yesterday?
After he won. I was actually at the truck stop in Gary, Indiana, and I heard it before I left the truck stop and while I was driving. I'm almost in Minnesota now, so.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm saying I still hear it every now and then, but most times now, most of the truck drivers don't even say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You mostly hear it when you pretty much stop somewhere.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the major point of that call is that there's still a lot of racial animosity out there, and there's going to be some racial animosity in how people see Barack Obama's presidency. So even with this historic election and the fact we have an African-American president, racism is still out there, and the problems of race are still very much a part of America. But that said, this is a turning point I don't think many people saw coming just a year ago. And it signals that some of the voices he was hearing from truck drivers are not clearly reflective of a majority of America. You know, there's all the talk about a Bradley effect, and it didn't happen. And so I think, you know, that pushes some of those voices farther to the side than before.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. And we don't exactly know. Some of this is hard to measure, isn't it? The effect of that, of an African American winning the White House, the effect on young people, the effect I was my son and friends of his were working in the election, and I think about what that will mean in their lifetimes. I think that that's a pretty big deal.
Oh, it's a huge deal. I mean, there's different ways in which we make progress on civil rights. So there's legislation, there's, you know, through popular culture. But what is more powerful than having the most powerful political figure in the country and one of the most powerful figures in the world being an African-American and winning the election by a pretty good number? This is not, he didn't squeak through.
Right.
He really won a large majority. And again, he did this in states that are pretty conservative on race. You know, like Virginia, which went Republican in part because of race since 1964. So I think for a lot of younger Americans, this is a kind of great, a great image, a great moment. Now, of course, he has to do well as president. But the racial component of this, I think, is very positive.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Our guest this half hour is Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The next hour of our program this day after the election, the author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do. So, of course, it'll be today why they voted the way they did yesterday. 800-486-8655 is our number. Colleen is next from Nina. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
Sure.
I would like to say that I saw the psychology of behavior way out there last night. And when people are losing their jobs and losing their homes and have no health insurance and everything is sinking under their feet, you can't scream at them and lambast another person the way Sarah Palin did. And I think I'm so proud that this election came out the way it did. It's what we raised our kids to believe. And I think if Sarah Palin wants to be president, this should be a huge lesson for her. Go back to school, take a history course, and shut your mouth until you can talk decently. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Professor.
Well, I think there.
Whoops. Hello? We lost the line somehow. Thanks, Colleen, very much for the call. We have this email we'll read while we're reconnecting. I'm a 59-year-old woman who's overjoyed. However, the election of Obama was the easy part. Now we have much to prove and accomplish. Barack Obama needs the continued support of every voter for the next 4 years. We as individuals need to show with our behavior that change can happen by volunteering, making education a priority, thinking and behaving green, treating one another with respect. It will be hard work for us all. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and we're happy to say that he's joined us quite a few times on the Ideas Network during this campaign and is one of our favorite political analysts. Let's go to Paul from Sister Bay next. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for taking my
call. Sure, Paul.
I feel like celebrating. I'm calling because many of the pundits have talked about the key moments in the campaign, but one I haven't heard is the 2004 election. I was so disappointed in the results of the 2004 presidential election that it forced me to get more involved. I couldn't watch from the sidelines anymore, and I think there's probably a lot of people out there who felt the same way. And I think this was maybe one of the key underlying components of the results of last night.
Do you think it factors in, Professor Zelizer?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of the story. Again, what we saw yesterday was in many key states, Democrats were knocking on doors, driving people to the polls in the last few days, and had really replicated what Republicans had done so well in 2000 and 2004 on getting out the vote. That was the name of the game. And I think part of it was people frustrated from 2004 who said, all right, I'm not standing on the sidelines. But it was also kind of a Democratic strategy by Axelrod. It defeated Hillary Clinton, and I think it helped defeat John McCain.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. We go next to Peg from Rice Lake. Hi, Peg.
Hi, Darren. I want to say that for the first time since I was 6 years old, I am truly proud of my country. And if that sounds kind of like Michelle Obama, something she said way back and she got just whipped for it, let me briefly tell you why. we finally have done this wonderful thing, and I do think it's wonderful. But we were not, last night I heard someone say, this proves what a great nation we are, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe so, but it was a long time coming. In the 1700s, the Quakers abolished slavery among their own membership. In 1794, the French colonies abolished slavery. I believe England was right in there somewhere, too. In 1829, get this, Mexico abolished slavery. It took us almost 40 more years to do it here. It's high time we finally saw the light. Thank you.
Thank you, Peg. Thanks very much for the call. I think that Michelle Obama will be a wonderful person to have in the White House. I think she's, when we talk about the level of discourse, the way that she speaks, both of them have this calming effect, and she's also extraordinarily smart. I look forward to the role that she fashions for herself as First Lady, don't you, Professor Zelizer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my guess is she'll face a little of what, you know, Hillary Clinton faced and Eleanor Roosevelt faced. The powerful, talented First Lady with opinions often comes under fire. So she has a political job as much as a ceremonial job, and I'm sure that will be part of what she experiences in the next 4 years. But I think she's going to be quite a powerful figure, and I think that will be, you know, something else that's healthy for the nation.
Let's go next to Peggy from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Hi, Peggy.
Yeah, I'm kind of responding to the gentleman, the semi-driver named Tyrone.
Tyrone, yeah.
I'm also a semi-driver, and early on, I was listening to a lot of the African-American drivers that were getting on and saying, a few of them were saying, vote for Obama because he's black. Okay. What I quickly found out is those people were being weeded out by the more intelligent voters who were saying, let's look at the best voter or at the best candidate. And after, there's highly intelligent people out there, and instead of let's vote because of his color, it was let's start voting because he's the better man. And I applaud all the truck drivers. It's very hard for us because so many of us have to do an absentee ballot because we're never home.
Right.
That's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
All right.
And congratulations, Obama.
Thanks very much for the call. We have a lot of truck drivers listening today. That's good. The New York Times had an interesting editorial today, and Obama talked about this when he addressed the people last night who had not voted for him, but he will still be their president. Tell me, Professor Zelizer, how these parties are going to have to work together at this point. We've been through a long, long time, eight years, and the country has become, as you know, more and more divided. What is it you think that the President Obama will need to do in order to bring people together? And as the Times suggested, the challenges we face are beyond the reach of any one man or any one political party. Hello? We'll ask him that question in just a moment. In the meantime, we'll go to a couple more of your phone calls, and Ryan is next from Whitewater. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. My concern now is after the campaign has been run, you know, is half the country scared to death now that they have a president that is a terrorist sympathizer? You know, are they scared that, you know, with all these internet rumors and all these false rumors about Obama? And what is going to be the lasting effect upon, you know, how negative that campaign was?
Okay. What about that fringe, Professor Zelizer?
Well, I mean, I think what was interesting is if you look at a state like Pennsylvania, where those appeals were made, John McCain didn't win. There was all this talk about blue-collar voters voting on race and how these kind of appeals of linking him to Bill Ayers and terrorism would work. They didn't work. And they didn't work in areas where people were scared they would. So I'm not sure half the nation bought that. That's not what the polls are showing. And so I think, you know, it might be Republicans who get a bigger lesson and move away from some of that kind of an argument toward different arguments in the future. But there will be a pocket of people. Look, there isn't many presidents. who are on the fringe, who are dangerous people. But, you know, I'm sure the Secret Service will be watching them.
Right. And you think of the number of those Reverend Wright ads, which everybody was complimenting McCain for not running or talking about him in the last days of the campaign. They were flooding the air, weren't they, in the last – I was watching an enormous amount of television, but they were everywhere the last 2 days.
And there's some interesting data that they ran them – for example, the state party ran it in Pennsylvania in the final few days, and it might have caused a backlash, increasing African-American votes in response
to that. Oh, interesting.
So I don't know how that played out either. But in general, I don't think the message from this is that those kind of appeals worked very well. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think that's what both parties are seeing.
Right. Thanks very much, Ryan, for your call. Thomas from Milwaukee, hello. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. In you mentioning the Reverend Wright ads, I personally am a Trinity member. It wasn't the fact that I was voting for a member of my church or because he's a black man. It's for the better candidate, the person who can take us from where we are now to where we want to be. Mm-hmm. I think Barack Obama is a qualified candidate for that. Michelle Obama by his side is very exceptional. We need more jobs, better health care, and hopefully we can see what he can do for the next 4 years, hopefully the next eight.
Thanks so much for your call, Professor.
I mean, the calls reflect one of the challenges Barack Obama is going to face. People expect a lot of him,
right.
And they have very high opinion about what he can do and who he is and the ideas he's going to propose. And again, the reality is he's inheriting a terrible economy, a problematic war, and almost no money in Treasury to do anything. So he has a challenge of leadership ahead of him, given if these calls are reflective of what people are expecting.
Right. And I think that he knows that. The reports are that late in the campaign he's talked about the fact that people expect so much of him, and he hopes that he's able to do a lot.
And he even made that part of his acceptance speech about how in the first, you know, year, the first few months, you know, people will disagree with him, there'll be missteps. And so I think he's incorporating that into his opening message, which I think is actually very smart. To lower the expectations or set the groundwork for some things will be off the table, there will be mistakes made. That's part of his skill as a communicator, and it's interesting he's doing that right off the bat.
Would you be interested in the next few days and beyond to see who he brings into the administration, Professor Zelizer?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is critical. You know, one of the things Carter and Clinton did wrong was to establish poor teams that were the liaisons to Congress. And so even though they both had Democratic Congresses to work with, they had bad people interacting with the legislative branch, and it led to poor relations and just disaster on one issue after another. You know, early on we have hints he might bring in Rahm Emanuel, who's a very popular and powerful Democrat in Congress, or Tom Daschle, former minority leader. And I think that's actually a pretty good sign. But I think watching who he puts into place is now the next big question.
Right. Do you know, I don't know if you know this or not, we were talking last night about what happens. Is it a special election or is it a gubernatorial appointment that will fill the Barack Obama seat and the Joe Biden seat in the Senate?
I'm not actually sure how the states handle that. I assume they have special elections, but I don't know if one of them has a gubernatorial appointment. I don't know how that will work.
Yeah, we'll ask our next guest to see what that story is. One more phone call and then we're almost out of time this hour. We could talk about this all day. We've talked about it for years. Why not all day? Kristen from Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my
call. Sure.
I'm an Obama supporter, but I initially really liked John McCain because he's been relatively moderate. And I think he actually did a horrible disservice to women by picking Palin. I feel like he was clearly trying to get Hillary voters to support him. And it's kind of insulting to think that people who supported Hillary would support Palin simply because she's a female.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that it was not a good choice for him. And I still can't quite understand why it was made, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, part of it, there might not be a good answer. I mean, that's the thing we hate to learn about campaigns. We think they're all methodically plotted out and you have the best people running them, but sometimes they just make horrible mistakes. I think his main goal was to energize conservatives about his candidacy, and he took a huge risk to do that. And in the process, he alienated many moderate Republicans, many independent voters, many Democrats who might have gone for him, and he even changed his own image from more of a moderate, maverick, bipartisan legislative leader to kind of a someone sympathetic to the far right. And so on many levels, it was just a bad choice. But that's what we learn in the history books, you know, and the record. Sometimes the campaign operatives just aren't so good. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Christian, thanks for the call. Professor Zelizar, I don't know if I thanked you, too, when you were with us last. It was our pledge drive, and you helped us raise a lot of money. Go. I don't know if you knew that, but thank you so much,
it's
people like you. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Our guest this half hour, Professor Julian Zelizar, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. We also thank Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, for being with us to talk about the presidential election held yesterday. Barack Obama will be the next president of the United States. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda as well for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Why we voted the way we did, we'll do some of that analysis the next hour of our program, so please stay with us. It's a minute before 10. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.